Hello, everybody. My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. And see, it didn't take 10 minutes. The running joke is that I get 10 minutes, no more, no less. But less is fine. It's funny. I was sitting up here, and I was watching people walk in the room. And I started seeing a lot of what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I've watched people walk in this room that have watched me try to get sober since I was 18 years old. And I just got goosebumps saying that. That's kind of funny. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now is I found Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18 years old. I got invited to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was in high school by a girl that I thought I probably wanted to go somewhere other than a meeting Alcoholics Anonymous with. And she invited me to one of the other fellowships, and my response was, I'm not going to any meeting where you narc on people. I don't care how anonymous it is. I wasn't going anywhere. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And they said, no, that's not what we do. It's a place where we go that you might be able to stop drinking and using the way you drink and use. And so I went, and I found out right away that I didn't want to be there. And that kind of rolled around for a little while, and I ended up getting in a little bit of trouble with the law. In fact, I ended up getting a lot of trouble with the law. They kicked me out of school, never wanted me back in the school district or anywhere near any of their students. And I ended up moving on to a probation high school, and at that time, I was introduced in depth to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started hanging out at a place called the ABC Club in Indio, which a place prior to that I knew was a place for drunks and winos, and I wasn't either, so I wasn't ever going to go there. Since then, I've lived there three times. So fast forward a little bit. That started a run through Alcoholics Anonymous where I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I would stay for extended periods of time. I would come in, I'd stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for a little bit over 3 years. And what I found out is that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I was able to stick around on feel goods. I was the type of person that no matter where I moved to or where I lived or what group I ran with, I was always able to adapt and fit in and make myself feel good because somebody took me into the room and opened the doors and accepted me. And I was usually able to get on really good behavior for a little while and fit and be accepted. And after a period of time, I wasn't really comfortable faking it anymore and I wasn't fitting, so the doors would eventually open up as fast as they opened up to let me in, and they would throw me out. And I would move on to the next series of people or circumstances or places or things that would make me feel good, and I would hang out there a little bit longer. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, it was really easy to feel good. I was no longer putting substances in my body that at the end of the day made me feel like crap. I say substances because we'll just clarify it really fast. I do nothing but Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did a lot more than alcohol when I was out there. And that's about all I'll say about my my cross addictions, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'd come in and out. And what started happening is I started here at the end of about a 10-year run of doing this, I had about 3 years I wasn't sober. And I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I put together 3 years, I'd leave for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And I'd come back and I'd put together 2 years and I'd leave and I'd go back out for 6 or 8 months, you know. And it was, the time frames are a little bit sketchy. But what I found out is exactly what they said, that the disease never stopped growing. I was able to come in here and get sober, and I'd go out there, and each time I would get drunk or loaded, I would be able to stay out there shorter periods of time before the wheels would fall off. And I'd come crawling back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and life would seem to get a little bit better the minute I walked in the doors. But I would never do what you guys told me to do. I would sit around, you know, in the beginning, I mean, it was the big thing to sit at Fellowship Hall and hang out on the patio and smoke cigarettes and see who was doing what and where we were going to go have dinner afterwards. And I tell you guys that the program Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't happen out there. I was really good at showing up at meetings and doing a whole lot of nothing but socializing. I was an egomaniac. I was really ego-driven. Again, it was look at me. I tell this story because it keeps me in check. I used to have a habit of pulling up to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with this piece of garbage, but it was mine, a boat, behind the back of my truck, saying I just picked it up from the shop, so you guys all knew I had it. It's the way I lived. I lived that way for a long time. It was, what did I have and what could I give you so you would be my friend? And when that stopped working, I would leave Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd go get drunk again. And after a series of 10 years of doing this, I was one more time. I had left. I had been out for a couple of months. I had gotten to the point where I was getting loaded and showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous and saying I was sober. The one thing that I could never believe people did. I could never believe that people showed up in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk and loaded, said they were sober and lied about their sobriety date. I just didn't think it was possible. And why would they do such a thing? But I got in a motorcycle accident, and I had started taking some pills, and they went from take as needed for pain to have pain so I can take them. It was very easy to mix the two up. And I left for a really short period of time. I was able to stay out there about 2 months, maybe. My wife usually corrects me on that. She's saying 3 from the back of the room. This is the fun part of the story because I don't remember it, and she does because I detoxed on her couch. So great for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was gone for about 3 months, and the wheels just fell off. Couldn't do it anymore. I found myself sitting in a place where I'd been drinking and using all night long, and the sun was coming up, and I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't loaded, and I wasn't too sure what to do. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I was sitting with my brother, and we were sitting there, and we were just trying to plan the next deal. What were we doing next? And it just didn't work. I couldn't get away from where I was because they, meaning the people that were my friends, had taken my truck, and they wouldn't bring it back to me. And so I was stuck. So I did the next best thing, and I called my sponsor, my old sponsor, thinking that he would come rescue me. And this conversation went something like this. It went exactly like this. I can't do this anymore, but I can't go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't work. And he said, well, I guess you're going to die, and hung the phone up on me. And I didn't know what to do. I was at a loss. And I didn't know what my next step was, and they finally came and got me, and the moment of clarity happened. I was driving out of La Quinta Cove, and it was January, somewhere in between the 1st and the 6th, because I remember we started partying New Year's night, and my sobriety is the 6th, so it was somewhere in between that period of time. And for some reason, the lights went on, and I remember seeing it like it was yesterday. It was one of the crystalest, clearest blue days I had ever seen in a long, long time. And I was really sick, guys. I thought I was going to die. I was burning up. I was just been sick. And I was laying my face against the car window because it was ice cold and it was making me feel good. And it was just crystal clear. And I saw a woman walking a dog down the street. And I don't know who she is, or I don't think I've ever seen her before or since. She was walking this great big black lab, and she didn't look like she had a care in the world. And I thought to myself, I said, if I had 5 minutes of freedom from my screwed up life long enough to go walk a dog, just 5 minutes long enough to take a dog down the street where everything and nothing else mattered and they would all just leave me alone, I would do anything. I would do anything anybody wanted me to do to get those 5 minutes. And this little voice said, why don't you go try it their way? And I came back to alcohol. Actually, I got a finished ride to my house, and that's where the days kind of get mixed up. I'm not too sure what happened, but I made a phone call, and one or two phone calls or something happened. I was just, like I said, I was really sick. I couldn't make it to the meeting, and they wanted me to. They said, "Why don't you come over?" There was my wife's house was one of those houses that everyone hung out at after the meeting, and. It turned out to be a Friday night after the Friday night speaker meeting at the ABC Club, and it was Saturday morning, and everybody was over there, and I made a phone call, and 15, 20 minutes later, from Palm Springs to Palm Desert, I was there, and they were taking care of me, and I was detoxing on the couch, and I wasn't too sure what was going to happen. I just knew I had to try it a different way, and I made a decision that day to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and do whatever they told me. I called my sponsor at that point, and we checked in and got kind of going on the road of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the beginning, I did it. clarify that one. In the beginning, I did everything he told me right when he told me. I clarify in the beginning, because now I've been sober a little while, don't you know I can take the wheel every once in a while and crash the car real well, but I can take the wheel. I came in here and I did what they told me to, especially when it didn't make sense and I knew it wasn't going to work. And that was January 6th of 1998. So God willing, in January I'll have 10 years. And as a result of getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life has changed considerably. I'm doing an occupation today that I didn't even know exist before I was sober. I have a wife and two awesome daughters. It's been rough at times, it's not easy. And it's not all rainbows and roses, A lot of the time it's piss and vinegar. And sometimes we just get through it. We got family deals. We don't have family deals. Finance issues, not finance issues. But Alcoholics Anonymous is always the answer if I'll buckle down and do it. With that, I want to thank you guys for letting me share. Don't leave. Don't leave, especially when you don't know what's going on. And the answer is never to walk out the door. It's always just to hang on for two more seconds. And it'll change. Might not get better, but it'll change. Thanks.
Thank you, Mickey, for sharing with us tonight.
Thank you. My name's Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. I'll take my glass. I think you're better blurry. First, I want to thank Tina for inviting me to talk. It's perfect timing for me. I moved here about a year ago, and I got sober in West Hollywood. I got sober mostly a meeting at Cedars Sinai Hospital Sunday morning. I used to sit up on the stage, and when I had about 2 weeks of sobriety, the secretary asked me to read chapter 5, and I went in the bathroom and threw up. And I'm feeling kind of that feeling right now. I'm not. This is not something I do a lot of. But if you don't hear anything else that makes any sense for me tonight, please know that without a shred of doubt, I know that Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And I know that if you continue to come here, it can do that for you too. My mantra when I do talk is tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth. And honestly, I don't want to tell the truth. I'm afraid I might bum you out a little bit. But on Sunday, I celebrated 23 years of sobriety. And thank you. And I got sober young. I was 22 right before my 23rd birthday. And I just, I've been obsessing about how do you cover 23 years of sobriety in 10 minutes, and I just don't even know where to begin. But Pam says I should just talk about what's going on right now. So I don't know if I can. I might just tell a story. I don't know. We'll see what comes out. When I was about 7 years sober, what happens to most of us that stay sober started happening to me. My life started coming together. I was no longer that kind of sniveling, whining, self-centered, horribly, painfully shy person that I was when I got here. And I started kind of putting a life together for myself. I had started a business and had a home, and I had a partner. And my partner worked at this place called Caring for Babies with AIDS, and she had these two little boys, twin boys, that she was the primary care person for. And it kind of came up that they were going to, they weren't babies anymore, they were three, and they need to place them somewhere else. So we took them in. And a very long story short, my partner started drinking again 3 months later, and I had these kids by myself. And I had them for about 9 months by myself. And, just typical Alcoholics Anonymous came to my rescue. They were there for me every single day, helping me get the kids off the bus, helping me, And this was my sponsor used to say to me every time something bad would happen to me. She said, "Well, that just added 2 minutes to your pitch." And this was that's all that was. That just added 2 minutes to your pitch. And this time she said, "Well, that added about 10 minutes to your pitch." So I've been thinking that maybe this is the right story to tell. So I had those kids by myself. Eventually they went back. Their mother was kind of in the picture, and they went back to live with her. And I thought this was a horrible, hideous thing to happen. She was young. My one little boy was sick. She was sick. I thought this was the worst possible thing that could happen to these kids and to me. But she took them back, and she had them for 2 years, and she passed away. And they eventually went to live with their grandparents. But I've stayed in their lives. I've gone there every year, and they've come here to visit me in L.A. And what I learned from that experience was, my sponsor used to tell me, "Lisa, you see like this. This is your vision. You only see what's in front of you. Try not to judge things as good or bad." Because what I thought was a horrible thing that was happening turned out to be the best thing for their mom, those kids, for me. And this is what I've been thinking about a lot, is my vision is so limited. That I've been in a lot of pain recently over, you know, my own doing. And I'm a little embarrassed about it because I think on a certain level I should be better. I don't know where I get that idea. I look at you, none of you are that much better. I mean, I see you having your lives and having problems and having issues and having... So I've been telling myself that for the last couple of days, that, you know what, try not to judge this situation as good or bad. I've been angry, which is an emotion I don't deal with very well, never have. And it eats me up inside. It really does. I know when they say that, I really feel that. It really eats at me. And I've had trouble letting go. Absolutely. It's not my favorite thing to do. I think I can control everything. I think I should be able to control my emotions and you and my life and how everything's going. But I really know now that I see like this, you know, that this is happening for a reason. It always, because of this situation, I moved to the desert a year ago to kind of get away from a person. And, you know, I'm looking around the room now, and I have made amazing friends already. I have history with those people in AA that I got sober with in L.A., and I'm starting to have a history here with you people, and I have to trust that this is the right place for me to be. I think one of the greatest gifts in my sobriety has been hearing people share, not just from the podium, but in my everyday meetings that I go to, that sharing ourselves with each other, that telling the truth. To me, it saved my life, because when I got here, I somehow learned that it was okay for me to tell the truth, that it was necessary for me to tell the truth. And I did. I cried and howled and bawled everywhere I went and just let it out. And people never threw me out. People never made it okay for me. Didn't make it okay for me to be there. And I've learned to do it, and I'm continuing to do it, even though it doesn't feel pretty to me at all. The other thing is that one little boy, they're 19, my twins are 19 now. They were 3 when I had them. And my Aaron, my one little boy, is coming to live with me here in about a month. And again, I know, it's full circle. It's like that's the way it was supposed to happen. I was supposed to be here for him now. And he was supposed to be here for me now, because I need someone to give what I have a way to, and he's the perfect person for that to happen for. So I don't know if I've gone 10 minutes, but I feel done. I'm really very, very glad to be here, and, you know, very impressed with what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for us. And I hope you enjoy the convention. Look forward to hearing that. Thanks.
My name is Marvin. I'm an alcoholic.
Marvin.
And I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come and to share at this meeting this morning. I absolutely loved the theme of the meeting, letting go absolutely, because I was one of these type of alcoholics that I had to get beaten into a state of reasonableness before I would ever consider the fact that maybe, just maybe, my life was unmanageable and that I had a problem with drinking. You know, through a series of events, a God of my understanding looked beyond my faults and gave me the gift of sobriety, and I went through a treatment facility up in San Francisco. And I remember when I got out, the first thing that was said to me, well, as I was leaving, one of the counselors came up and said, Marvin said, if you do not leave this place and get plugged in tonight in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will find yourself coming back here again, and you will join the revolving door. So I got out, and I didn't have a car, so I was walking down the streets of San Francisco, and every time I passed the bar, they would wink at me, and that was exactly where I wanted to go. You know, the smell of the sawdust on the floor, the laughter of the people on the inside of the bar, that's where my heart was, and that's what I wanted more than anything, I thought. But, you know, as I kept on walking down the street, all of a sudden I thought, no, I really want to stay sober. So I went to a meeting, and it was on Clay Street there in the city. It was a Saturday night meeting, and it was at Clay and Van Ness. And I went to that meeting, and I sat right in the middle on the very back row. And I had remembered that they told me, you have to get a program, Marvin. You must get a program to live by. And I thought, okay, I'll get a program to live by. The only thing is for the 40 days I was in the treatment center, I never, ever understood what the program was or what they were talking about when they said the program. So I sit down on the middle aisle. I sit there. And all of a sudden, this nice-looking person came in with a briefcase and a suit and tie on, and they put their briefcase down, they opened it up, and they took out some pieces of paper about this size and laid them down. And I thought, well, he must be the secretary here, and he's the one that hands out the program, so I'm in the right place. You know, and I sit there, and he took these little things, and he began to pass them out to people. And he would get right up close to me, and he would go to the left-hand side. And I would think, wow, they're getting the program. And so I went back the next week, and the same ritual went on, and he did his little thing. And I thought, he never comes to me. I'm not going to get the program. I don't want to drink, but I've got to have a program or I'm going to drink. And I had noticed that he gave and favored the left-hand side of the room. So the next Saturday when I went there, I sit over on the left-hand side saying, I know that I'll get the program tonight. And instead of coming to the left-hand side, he went to the right-hand side. You know, but I came back again, and this time I went over to the right-hand side, and he went to the middle section again. A matter of fact, right on the very back row, he handed somebody one of these little sheets of paper, and I thought, oh my God, these people just don't want me to get the program. You know, I'm doomed to die because they won't give me the program. You know, and so finally in frustration, I just sit there one night. I went back to sitting in the middle section, the very back seat. And he was getting up, and he was going to the left, and he was going to the right. And I thought, well, it's not going to give one to me, you know. And he came walking toward me, and as he came walking toward me, my heart began to beat, and I got this warm feeling all over me. And he walks up to me, and he says, would you like to read tonight? And I said, yeah, I'd like to read. And he handed me a piece of paper about like this, and as soon as he gave it to me, I said, oh, I've got the program, you know. And I did one of these kind of numbers, and I looked down at it. And when I looked at it, it said, we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And truly, I was given the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. You know, and what happened to me, it was from that night that I got launched into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out real quickly, I can't come and just warm a bench. I can't come and just be present and look pretty in a meeting. I have got to get involved in my sobriety. I have got to get involved with life again. I had withdrawn from life for so long, and now it was time to integrate back into life. You know, and this was something that was foreign to me. What that did when I got launched, it push me forward. So I got a sponsor, you know, and my sponsor began to take me through the steps and begin to do the things that begin to change my life. And the one very, very important piece of information that my sponsor gave me in those early years, he said, "Now, Marvin, whenever your family starts coming back, whenever the job gets calm again, whenever your bills start getting paid, when all of these gifts that you're going to receive because that you are sober and you are thinking clearly, when all of these things begin to come back, please, for God's sake, do not lose those things again because you're not paying attention to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, you get your family back and you think, "Wow, I got my family back, so I'm sure God wants me to stay home with my family." And so we start staying home with our families, or we start working a lot of overtime, and the first thing you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous loses its luster. It loses that glow. It loses that magic that it had when we first came in, you know, and we begin to drift. And we begin to think, "Well, it won't hurt this time." The only thing is, every time I said "it won't hurt this time" left me at 2 o'clock in the morning pounding on a bar saying, "How did this happen once again?" And my name is Marvin. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.
Oh, God. Hi, I'm Nikki, alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to say that it's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to be asked to speak here tonight. And I want to thank Tina for asking me. This is definitely stretching my sobriety. You know, it's definitely putting me in a place where I can't say that I never wanted to be on stage. That would be a lie. I just thought I'd hear Oscar music or something like that, and, you know, my adoring fans screaming my name. Yeah! Oh, stop. But, you know, I never did anything to earn that before. But I definitely earned my place here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I only have 10 minutes to tell you what it was like, what it's like now, and my total experience. And the best way that I can do that is describe to you the feelings that I've had for most of my life. And, you know, growing up, I had, because I don't have it anymore, I've had all these feelings of loneliness. That's the best way that I could possibly describe it to you, is loneliness and fear. I've never known much of a life outside of those two things, and they have always pushed me to do all the actions that I've done in my life. The loneliness, it pushed me to reach out and try to take from whatever, whomever was around me, just so that I could feel safe, that I could feel okay. And you know what, that's really difficult when you're a teenager, because the only people around are teenage boys, and they don't have a lot to give, you know? But I still kept trying. I kept trying with the best of me to not feel that hole that was inside of me, to try to grasp onto whatever I can. And it started out, you know, I feel deep in my heart that I started out, like I feel that most alcoholics start out as codependents. And, you know, that person, place, thing, anything that you could have that will fill that hole up. And, you know, nothing ever worked. I'm a child of an alcoholic also, well, an addict and an alcoholic. I get it honest. Both sides of my family are infiltrated with this disease. My grandfather died of cirrhosis of the liver. My father is an alcoholic. My mother is a recovering addict, which I'm very happy about. And she's the one that introduced me to this disease. To this, don't tell her I said that, but she introduced me to this program very unwillingly. I've been going to AA, well, I wasn't going, you know, participating, but I was in AA meetings since I was 13 when she got sober, and I've had a huge, huge resentment against AA because instead of giving me a mother, it gave me a sponsor. You know, so if you can imagine being 13 years old and going to your mom and crying because he did this, she did this, and the first thing you hear is, well, what could you have done differently to change the situation? Yeah, that didn't work out too well for me at 13. And, you know, I went through my life. Okay, so we start with the loneliness and fear. It goes on. Loneliness and fear, loneliness and fear, loneliness and fear. And when I got to college, it got a little worse. I became a stalker at that point. Yeah, that was fun. You know, you might not be able to tell, but you know, I was that hiding behind the bushes kind of girl. You know, I waited up to 2-3 o'clock in the morning for somebody to get home so I could catch him. Yeah, that wasn't good. That was actually quite embarrassing, but I'm glad I could laugh at it today. That's the amazing part of my journey, is that I can laugh at those things today. And, you know, I went through a bout where I thought maybe that I was schizophrenic. And, you know, I was ready to go into an insane asylum or wherever, anything. You know, I would prefer to be drugged up for the rest of my life at that point in time than to face myself and to look at myself. I want to talk about my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved out here to Rancho Mirage to work at Eisenhower Medical Center. Little did I know that that move, which, you know, I was afraid to do anything. So the fact that I moved here and was able to move from Florida to a whole nother state and not know a single soul was definitely a God shot for me. I got here and my drinking went down really, really fast. You know, I was a party drinker. I was one of those people that liked to go to clubs all the time. I even worked in the industry that was surrounded by alcohol. I was a nightclub promoter for 5 years before I moved out here. So my whole life centered around partying and drugs and alcohol and men or women, whatever was around or who was closest. And so then I moved out here trying to do the 9-to-5 thing. It was a shock to my system. It was a shock to my complete being that I was going to be normal. Ew. That is the scariest thing. It was the scariest thing in the world for me was to be a normal person in society. How boring and uneventful that I thought that was. And so I kept trying to fill myself with liquor. So my last year of drinking was daily drinking. I was almost at the morning. I was almost there. I could taste it, you know, every morning. I thought it was there, but then I found pills. And so I did that in the morning instead. And my drinking went down pretty fast. In a year's time, I hit bottom. And with all the years that I had been drinking, I couldn't have imagined that I would be in California, a daily drinker, with that desperate, desperate need. I heard somebody say in one of the meetings today about needing to drink every day. You know, that desire, it wasn't just about partying. I couldn't believe it because before I moved out here, I was drinking every day, but I was drinking because I was working every day. At least that's what I told myself anyway. And when I came out here and then I started drinking every day, I'm like, I'm drinking the same amount I would have been drinking at a club, but I'm just sitting at home? You know, that just didn't register. And I was starting to drive drunk a lot. You know, I would buy those little wine spritzers, the little ones, and thought I would buy just two to curb my drinking. And then that wouldn't work, so I'll go get the whole bottle or two. You know, it was that progressiveness and then that waking up in the morning with that deep, deep sense of impending doom. You know, I thought that was a myth. an urban legend or something. You know, when I heard it early in my teens, I thought you people were just exaggerators. Well, you are, but, you know. You know, I thought that your experience really wasn't as bad as you tried to make it seem until it happened for me. And it was desperate, and it was cruel. You know, it was just cruel to wake up every single day and not want to be alive. You know, I just wish that something would happen. You know, I never did that whole suicide thing or anything like that. I just wish that somehow, some way, it would just end. It would be painless. But that never happened. And on my last day of drinking, my last night drinking, I hit a parked car. Luckily, there was nobody else in the car. The only thing that happened was my side view mirror broke off. And all of a sudden, I had that spiritual experience where I was sitting in the car, and next thing you know, my life flashed before me. Not the past, but the future. You know, I saw the jails, I saw the institutions, I saw myself wrapped up in this pretty little white coat with my arms like this, and I thought that that really doesn't go with my complexion, so I decided that that wouldn't work for me, and I don't like fluorescent lights either. And so, you know, the next day I woke up and I said, you know what, I'm going to call. I called a couple of recovery homes. You know, it didn't dawn on me to call AA right away. I knew it was there, but that was just like, you know, I didn't want to go there. I just didn't want to be in AA, for Christ's sake, you know. When my mom got sober, she got sober with a lot of low-bottom drunks. And I'm like, I don't like that. It doesn't look pretty. It doesn't look like somewhere I would want to be. And, you know, I had to wait to get into recovery, so I knew where I had to go. And I had to go to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I tried it a couple of times since I'd been here during the year, but I go and I go drink and I go, no, it's not right. I don't want to be there. But something happened this time after having that spiritual experience. You know, I saw, I can't even explain it. It's one of those things that it was just like, you know, you just know. You know, and I hope that if you're new, that you're desperate enough to say that, hey, I'll try it no matter what. I was willing to give up a lot of things when I came to AA. I was willing to give up fun because I was sure I would never have any again. I was willing to give up being a social person because I'm pretty sure I would not be able to talk to another human being without a drink in my hand. And I was willing to give up whoever I thought I was. You know, I thought that, you know, I wrote myself a letter early in sobriety, and it was like a goodbye letter. Because I thought, oh, I get sober, I could still do the same things I did before, except I just won't drink. Well, that dream came crashing down really fast. And I wrote myself a letter, and I said, you know, dear Nick, I love you, but you're standing in the way. You're killing me. And I knew that I had to give up everything. Every way that I thought, every friend that I had that was involved with drinking, I knew that I had to give it up. Because I didn't want to die that way. You know, some of our character defects really do help us along the way. Because I was too vain to die of alcoholism. I was like, oh, no, they're not going to say that about me. Uh-uh. You don't get to do that. You don't get to say, ooh, look how she died. You know. So thank God for that character defect. Because that jumped right in, right on time. Anyway, so I jumped in with both feet first. You know, I was so desperate to have relief. And I realize now, looking back on it, that's all I ever really wanted, was some relief from my head, from what I thought people were thinking about me. Just some relief of knowing that I'll be okay. Anything just to be okay was all I ever wanted. And my good friend Stacy put it so perfectly one time. She's like, I was searching, but I had no idea what I was searching for. And I found it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got about 90 days sobriety, and I was about ready to take my fourth step because I did 1, 2, and 3 in recovery. And then it was time to do my fourth step, and I said, no, I'll wait. I like this sobriety thing. Let's not ruin it with a fourth step. And then life jumped up, of course, and bit me in the ass, and I said, where's the pen and paper? I can't do this anymore. Whatever you say, I'll do it. And I did it. I did it, and I came out on the other side. The world didn't come crashing down. My chicken little syndrome had kind of disappeared a little bit. The sky did not fall, and I'm okay. So just a word to those people who are afraid to do that fourth step. I understand. The fear for me was so real. And then I realized that the fear wasn't about what was on that fourth step. It was about that the truth was coming out. And that I would have to look at it, and I would have to face it, and I would have to do something about it. And that was the scariest part for me, is taking responsibility to actually do something about my past, to actually look at it and say, oh my God, that's not who I am. And anyway, I just do this thing one day at a time. I got over that whole fear of doing the steps, and it has given me a life of freedom today. You know, I get to look at myself in the mirror and say, oh my God, you have integrity? We never even knew what that was. And I still talk in the we thing because we're still together up there, and we still have conversations, and, you know. But that's okay, because they don't yell and scream at me and call me the B word in the morning anymore. And, one of the things that really turned my sobriety around was the women's meeting. I went there, and we were read Keys to the Kingdom. And it was that last part that we read that says, there's no more aloneness. With that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. And I cried and I cried, and I'm like, I'm finally home. I'm finally home. And that is the most amazing feeling that I've ever felt in my life, because that's all I ever wanted. I only ever wanted to feel comfortable. I only ever wanted to feel loved. And I found that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful to be here. And I'm grateful to see all your faces. I have so many heroes today. You know, I have integrity today. I'm honest. That was tough. You know, I can look people in the eye today and I can say whatever it is that I need to say. I can set boundaries. I can tell you that you don't get to do that to me today. And I can tell you, yes, you can do that today. And I think that my time is up, and I just wanted to welcome all the newcomers. Welcome home. This is a beautiful place to be, if only you have the willingness to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Luther Wood, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very happy to be here this morning. I love being with you. I see my friend. Thank you, Tina, by the way, for asking me to come and share this morning. And I've worn this this watch so that I could. I wore it so that Howard would feel secure that I was not going to run over. But I may look at it from time to time, but I'm really not, I don't care what time it is. So, And also, I had to stay up with him Friday night until 1 minute after midnight to make sure that he stayed sober. So we had a little watch out here in the lobby, if any of you saw us with eyeballs locked together and heads locked together. And I love Howard. He's my favorite scientist. He's my brother in many ways. And, you know, there's a line in Alcoholics Anonymous that says a fellowship will grow up around you, and that's happened to me. It's very degrading to see in the program here that I only have 34 years, because this month I will also be 35. Howard likes to say things like, let's see, is it 2 weeks more that I have of you, or is it 30 days? And so I have to, you know, they never let you forget it, that they have more time than you do, and he has 11 days more than I do, okay? So I'm going to clear all that up right this minute. And but anyhow, a fellowship does grow up around us one day, and it just happens, you know? There's a line in our book that says, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us, and I believe that as well. And I think a fellowship is very much the same, that it just happened one day that my closest friends and the people that I love are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you know what? I've been on the firing line here. I've stayed here. I've gone to lots and lots of meetings. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I didn't have a power greater than myself. I came because you had one. You know, I'd sit next to you, and you had so much of it that it spilled all over me. I never dreamed ever in the lifetime that I would have a power greater than myself. You know, but I'm here to tell you this morning that it is available to everyone, and it's available to all who seek. All you got to do is put your time in here, and do the thing that we do here, and work these steps. You know, these steps are what transformed me and changed me. I see my friend Candy here too. Candy calls me Sam, and she has for many, many, many years. I don't know why exactly, but she says I remind her of Sam more than anything, so she calls me Sam. I ran into her at a meeting at where Alabama used to be over there at Radford, and I came racing in one night. I needed a meeting really bad, and there was a woman talking. She had 30-something years, and I'm sitting there, and the more the woman talked, the crazier I got, and I couldn't understand a word she said, and I thought, my God, what's happened to my mind, you know? And Tammy jabbed me in the ribs. I'd never seen her before, and she said, honey, if you don't understand a word this woman's saying, don't feel bad about it. I've known her for all the taller sobriety, and I don't understand a word she'd say, you know. And I swear to God, it was like, whew, you know, because I have this kind of brain that I think I'm going to be locked up one more time, any old time. And I was locked up a lot. I drank enough that my brain was totally gone, and I was crazier than shit. Most, you know, I was just... I went to the Nut House 5 times as a direct result of drinking. And I was sitting in my senior problems class when I was 17 years old. My teacher looked out over the class and said, one of you in here, one of the 25 of you one day will go to the Nut House as a direct result of drinking. And I remember saying consciously, it won't be me. And so I went 5 times to the Nut House. You know, I went enough that when I got there, it was like, again, it was like, shoo, you know, because I was safe in the Nut House. I liked living in the Nut House. It was a sense of security there. I had a place to sleep. You know, I wasn't waking up underneath somebody's car or in the bushes or whatever, or hungry one more time. I was fed 3 times a day. I could take a shower anytime I wanted. They locked the doors at night so they can't get in. And that's the way I looked at it anyway. And it never occurred to me I couldn't get out. You know, but they couldn't get in. And also they left the lights on at night. And that was a big, significant thing for me because, you know, when it's dark, whatever's in the wallpaper seems to animate and come out and visit and do all this. And so I had a sense of security, you know, when the light was on. So, you know, that I was in the Nut House 2 years before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about you guys. I had no idea, nothing, no idea of where I belonged. I just thought I was in the right place because I was locked up and should be. And when I left the Nut House finally, obviously I got out. even though they had given me a really stiff examination called the, it was an MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is a strange kind of examination. It's there are really no answers. You know, they're all true and false, and like one of the statements is like, I am afraid of fire, true or false. And how do you answer that? You know, I'm not afraid of a match, and yet I'm afraid of if I were in a building, you know, way up in the air and it was on fire, I'd be afraid. So anyway, all paranoid schizophrenic people answer these questions a certain way, and they were so delighted to find out that I was paranoid schizophrenic. So, you know, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not today. I'm here to tell you that there's a healing power in Alcoholics Anonymous that is beyond your imagination, that will restore you to sanity in so many ways you just can't believe it, you know. I believe that we in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, are healers and storytellers. It's just, that's who we are. That's our lot in life, you know, to share our experience and our strength and our hope with other people who identify immediately, because we're all like two drops of water, you know. So I went on for two more nightmarish years of drinking after I got out of the nut house that last time. I got to a place where I have one of these brains. I have 26 conversations going on in here at all times, you know. And I got to a place in my drinking where I completely and totally gave up. I couldn't function anymore. I just gave up. I got to a place where, you know, my father years ago threw me out of the house and said, "You, there's no room for you here. You can't stay here anymore. We can't stand anymore. As far as we're concerned, you're dead." You know, and I know how hard it was for my father to tell me that, because he loved me. You know, but I got to a place in my drinking where I realized that his prophecy was coming true. I was dying, and I knew that, but I didn't know where to go. I had no idea. I did not have the presence of mind to do anything about it. So I went on to a place where I stopped doing anything really complicated, like bathing or taking my clothes off. Those are the days of really tight bell-bottom trousers, and it was dangerous getting in and out of those things drunk, you know. And to take a shower, you had to pull that door and that tub enclosure thing, you know. I was black and blue. I had cuts. I had broken glass all over the place. I just quit doing anything really complicated like that. And occasionally I'd slip out of my little cave of an apartment there and go steal another bottle of wine. I started drinking Tokay wine, and I ended drinking Tokay wine. And when I left my house in the morning to steal another bottle, the dogs in the neighborhood would chase me all over the goddamn place. And just because, you know, dogs and animals know that something strange has gone by. And so, you know, and it was up there at Thrifty after I'd just stolen me a bottle of wine, and I was out in the phone booth. And talking to a psychiatrist who was saying, "I can't help you," and I went in the blackout and came out the other side. Somehow or another, I'd gotten a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous, and somebody said, "Stay right there where you are, and we'll be down to get you." You know, and I must have told them where I lived, because I went home, and these three guys came into my living room. My doors and windows were wide open. All the lights were on upstairs and downstairs. People had been coming in there for weeks. They'd stolen everything that wasn't nailed down on the ground floor. And some guy walked straight up to me and said, "We've been right where you are," which infuriated me, because I jumped up. I said, "You have never been where I am." You know, I know loneliness, despair, and frustration as only the alcoholic knows it. And the other guy there with him said to me, "This will show you the frame of mind that I had." He said, "What are all those little scraps of paper all over the coffee table there?" Which I had cigarettes and wine bottles and short dogs, and I had 1,000 little notes. And he wanted to know what those little scraps of paper were, and that made me mad too. I said, "For your information," I said, "these things were important. This was my office, like, you know, it had all my ambulance bills on it and stuff, and insurance policies that I'd cashed in, and phone bills and all kinds of stuff. But they had little notes every place. They were all about velocity and time and speed and space-time continuum." And I said, "For your information, these little scraps of paper have formulas on them that Albert Einstein wanted to release to the universe, but he died before he was able to. And I'm the channel that he's writing them through." And I said, "By the way, he's my grandfather." So, which he is not, but it would not be odd that I would tell you that. And so my grandfather was my my idol. I identified with him in more ways than one. And that's who they took off into the night with them. And I'd like to say that it took me home and I went to sleep, but actually it took me home with them and I passed out. And came to the next morning and heard all these voices and followed the voices. I was in a strange house and strange. I was in somebody else's pajamas. None of this was new. I just didn't know where I was. And so I followed the voices out to the kitchen, and there they were sitting around the kitchen. And somebody leaned over and looked at me. And they were laughing, too, by the way, and smoking cigarettes and taking pills. I thought I was back in the nut house. Actually, they were taking vitamins. And they shoved a protein drink in my hand, and I started to drink it and threw it up instantly because milk and me don't get along when I'm that drunk, you know. And I was sitting there and on the edge of my seat, and they were trying to make me laugh, and I wouldn't laugh because I knew if I started laughing, I wouldn't be able to stop, and they'd come and get me and take me off to the nut house one more time. So someone said to me, do you know it's the first drink that gets you drunk? And I said, what? Because I didn't know that. I always thought I shouldn't have had the last one. If I just hadn't had that last half pint, I wouldn't have gotten my face rearranged, my black eye, back in the nut house, in jail, or whatever, or in a wreck. You know, uh-uh. They said it's the first one that sets up something in you that it does not in other people. You know, that I can often say, I'll sit down and have a glass of wine with my grandma. She goes to bed and I go to jail, you know. So that began my morning in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that morning, the dam broke for me, and I started to cry because I realized that I was with people who were like me, and I had never run into you before, ever, you know. That began my journey. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been very generous to me. They took me through these steps that I told you earlier that transformed me and changed my life. They gave me a power greater than myself. I worked really hard for them. By the time I finished my fourth step and sat down at that table, I started to cry one more time because I realized I hadn't the ability to get that thing together. I had had so much help along the way. As a matter of fact, in the middle of that fourth step, I said, I think I'm going to die. I think I'm going to die from this. And they said, well, that's the idea. You know, the old had to die completely so that the new could come. And that's been my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's a never-ending journey. Bill Wilson refers to us as an ever-advancing creation. And I believe that down deep inside where I live today. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a God-shaped hole in my soul. And it's a God-shaped hole. I thought for years, maybe it was the shape of a Mercedes and that would fill it. Or maybe it was the shape of a bag of money and that might fill it. Or the shape of a brunette might fill it. It's a God-shaped hole. Only God can fill it. It'll get filled up here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the last door in the hallway before the window. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Billy. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I'd like to thank Paul for asking me to come share. I'm sober 14 years. I've got sober on August 20th, 1992. And I think that through this small amount of time that I have, the one thing that, you know, I've only got 10 minutes, so I'll make it brief and to the point. The thing that's always meant the most to me in Alcoholics Anonymous and in my own sobriety is what happens. You know, we all know what it was like, then there's what happened and what it's like now. And the what happened has always been the most important thing to me. And if I ever get welled up or choked up or emotional on anybody's story, when I listen to people speak or people share at participation meetings, it's what happened that always turns me, or that's at the moment that I, you know, identify with anybody, because we're all here because something happened. Briefly, I'll just tell you who I am. You know, I'm an Irish Catholic. I was born in Long Island, New York. I'm one of 11 children, Irish Catholic family. I was the ninth. My dad died when I was 14 years old. He died drunk. And my mom was, you know, a raging Al-Anon by the time he died. And, I was very young, very impressionable, but this is where I come from. Fast forward to, you know, I graduated high school. I got fairly good grades. I went to college. Then I dropped out of college, and I moved to California. Briefly to tell you, I had no skills. No skills. I mean, I didn't know how to have relationships. I didn't know how to make money. I didn't know how to save money. I knew how to spend it, but I had no other skills at managing my life. And the very end of my drinking, this is, I can only tell you briefly what it was like, but at the end of my drinking, I had this little two-seater sports car, bologna skin tires, shredded up convertible roof that I just had to keep down. And I would come home from work at 5 o'clock and I would say, I'm not going to drink tonight. And I would go into my bedroom and I'd literally lie down on my hands like that was going to stop it. And I used to look at the clock and it would be 5:30 or it'd be 6 o'clock, 6:30. No way. By 6:30, 7 o'clock, I was up. I was in that sports car and I started to get that burning sensation down in my abdomen because I would have to drink. And I would remember shifting gears with my right hand, holding the door to the car open with my left hand, steering with my knee, and vomiting out the passenger window because that sensation was just completely overwhelming. I was on this tidal wave and there was no stopping it. And I know that we've all experienced that on some level. You know, I used to dream that I was in this roller coaster. And I wake up cold sweats because I couldn't get off this roller coaster. And it really was. It was the roller coaster of alcohol. And it had me, as it says in the book, completely in its grip. And it was king alcohol to me. So what had happened was I'd go to work every day. And this is my short story of what happened. I was going to work every day and I was starting to shake and my hands, I couldn't stop. But I couldn't go in. I couldn't go in drunk. I was sitting close to 5 or 6 or 8 other people in an area at work. So I was really trying to maintain it. I was trying to keep it together. You know, like we do at the end, we try to keep it together. It's just everything was, I was just trying, you know. I was always trying to polish my shoes and trying to comb my hair and trying, it just, and I just could never get it. I just, inside it was just turbulent. It was shaking. But in walks this guy who's got, you know, pleasant demeanor, very happy-go-lucky, skipping along. He's not really, you know, causing no problems. He's a really great guy. And he befriends me. And this is going on for 4, 5, 6 months. And he's my friend. And he's won my trust. I don't know anything about the guy other than, you know, he's married and he has a little condo over in Burbank and he shows up at work every day. And he was always on time. And, he had a $7 an hour, $5 an hour little job. He was a file clerk at this insurance company. He was older than me by 10, 15 years. And I'm thinking, God, what's this guy got going on? He's had a tie on and a suit jacket every day. You didn't need to wear that, but he wore it every day. He has the most pleasant demeanor. And I don't know how, but over months, he's gained my trust. Because now I'm starting to open up a little bit to this guy. Like, my phone wasn't ringing anymore at the end. It was just me and my job, you know. And I'm opening up. And so one day, out of nowhere, I got a little shake. It's about 10 o'clock. It's break time. We go up to this little coffee shop to get a little ham and egg sandwich. We only have a 15-minute break. And I'm coming back and I'm eating, you know, the coffee, you know, and I'm ripped, completely annihilated from the night before, completely drunk because one more time I couldn't stay sober, not a day. And I said to him, and I don't know where this came from, but I had said to him, you know, I think I got a drinking problem. I mean, I really think this is starting to get to where I couldn't stop. Now, I'm saying that. I couldn't stop for years. But I said to him, you know, I just think I can't stop. I think it's really gotten to the point where he reaches into his pocket, pulls out one of those little brass medallions with the little Roman numeral 6. And he flips it up at me. I'll never forget it. Like high in the air, I put my hand out, falls into the palm of my hand, and it says, to thine own self be true, and it had the Roman numeral 6. And I never saw one of those chips, ever. And I knew exactly what that meant. It was like this wave had come over me, because I knew that 6 meant he had 6 years. He never once broke his anonymity in the 6 or 7 months at this point that I had known him. He'd never once said anything to me about my drinking, and he knew I had a problem. And so I said, oh, my God, I can't believe it. You got 6 years sober. Reaches out, grabs the chip, sticks it in his pocket, walks away. So now I'm standing there. Now he sits behind me in the cubicles at the job. Now I'm sitting there. All I can think of is, you son of a bitch. Because I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, you should be kissing my ass. You should be licking my feet. I just told you I can't stop drinking. You show me that you're sober and you walk away. But I had never asked for his help. Now we go back inside to the office. We sit down, and now it's really starting to get hot. Because he knows I have a drinking problem. I know he's sober. And he's sitting 4 feet back of me. And I was like, whoa, now what do I do? What do I do? I gotta clear this up. How am I supposed to do that? And you know, the whole day went by, and I finally got the guts, because I'm sweating now, and it's not just from the alcohol. I mean, I'm sweating. He comes over. You know, I said, come on outside. I want to talk to you. And I said, you know, I don't know. Obviously, you've been sober a while. He goes, yeah, I'm sober in AA. I got 6 years. And I said, well, will you help me? And, oh, my God, of course. Well, of course I'll help you. That's all you had to say. Because he wasn't going to say anything to me unless I had asked for his help. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I really believe that. I mean, if they're not asking, they're not listening. It doesn't matter how long you have sober. You know, I have a lot of friends that are very attractive, and they're very calm in their demeanor, and they walk the walk, and, you know, they have great sobriety. And they are attractive. But if you're not ready, you're not ready. And if the alcoholic's not asking, they're not listening. And it really is attraction, not promotion. And when I had asked him, then all bets were off. Because then he could tell me anything he needed to tell me, because I had asked. And at that point, I said, well, will you help me? And he said, of course. And, you know. And then I started, now I wish I could tell you I got sober. No. It would be 3 years before I would get sober. I did everything. I mean, I didn't go to meetings. I took bogus chips. I got a legitimate chip for 30 days out the door. I took 60 days out the door. I had real chips. I had bad chips. And he used to say to me, he'd pull me outside and go, listen, don't go near the supervisor today. I go, why not? And he'd go, well, you smell like booze. And I go, I know. I had a couple beers last night. He'd go, a couple beers last night? To smell like that, you drank a case. And I would think, God, how does he know? And then I never figured out how, like, he knew everything. And then he said to me, you know, why don't you just go to a meeting and just go to one every day? And I said, well, I don't want to go to a meeting. He said, you don't have to want to go. You just have to go. And he always told me the truth, and it hurt. And there were things that he said to me. One time he said one thing, and I went, wow, this guy's reading my mail. He said to me, he said, you know, I remember when it was like when I used to party. He goes, even when I was the only one at the party. And I went, wow, this guy's got my number. Because at the end, the shades were drawn. I was peeping out the windows. I was going into the closet of an empty house to take a swig of my flask. I mean, I was really twisted out. So long, fast forward to the very end, I had a legitimate 30 days, and this guy was the perfect representation of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never lied to me. He always showed up on time. He always did what he said he was going to do, and he never told me anything that I had to do that was outside of what was the program of AA. He never had me come clean his car. He never asked me to participate in, you know, any of his personal life. It was all about sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a tremendous inspiration. And he was always honest, which to me, where I come from, that was a difficult thing for me to. And there was the trust of one man, and that's what he gave me. He gave me the trust of one man. It was one man that was the bridge to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And what I finally got a real 30-day chip. And I remember this guy never called me. My sponsor never, never called me. called me. But when I would call him, he'd stay on the phone as long as we needed. And he never said, oh, I'm busy, can I call you back? There was never any of that crap. He was on the other end of that phone, and he was listening to me. Like, this guy was like an angel. So I had a legitimate 30 days, and my phone rings, and it's him. And I was always picking up my phone because I knew he would never call. So I picked up my phone, and it was him. And I said, oh, Mark, I got 30 days sober, but I wouldn't call you. I wouldn't call you because I knew that you knew I was lying and that I would never be able to get this thing. I'd never be able to stay sober. So I just figured I wouldn't call you because I'd lied to you so much about times and sobriety and what I was doing that I just figured you wouldn't sponsor me anymore. And he said, Bill, I'll always sponsor you. And, you know, it's like he didn't give up on me. He stayed through to the end. The difference now versus what I would before was that I actually started to actually work the steps. And when I started to work the steps and I came to him with my first, second, third, fourth, fifth, that was when, you know, the music of AA started to really sing to me. That was when it changed for me. All the other stuff was just peripheral. It meant nothing. But when I actually started to work the steps and take his guidance and call him daily, that was when it shifted for me. But when he said, Bill, I'll always be your sponsor, I knew that there was that unconditional acceptance of my behavior and whatever character defects I had going on. It didn't matter to him. He was there like the Rock of Gibraltar. In my lifetime, I can never pay this man back for what he's done. And then, of course, as we know, as we stay sober, our world gets bigger and we're standing on more and more and more and more property and ground as time goes on and things get more stable. And Mike, I welcome to you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a big deal for you to come up here and you know, to accept this book and say, you know, you're an alcoholic with 10 days. It's, you know, the 30-day gentleman. It's a big deal. So I want to thank all of you for having me here, and I want to thank everybody on this committee that provided us a place for our common welfare. I think it's tremendous that you guys have come together to make this convention. It's meant my sobriety for the weekend. So I'll shut up. Thank you. Thank you.